world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Since evolution is also a faith, since it is a religion with its own dogmas, then how come it's still allowed in the classroom? They didn't let us talk about God and teach the kids how to pray, but they sure do tell some stories about how we all came to be here. Oh yes, mom and dad and the dogs, the cats, the pigs, the chickens, and the cows. The whole story is a wonderful little bit of mythology. One of the most interesting stories you can ask children to believe in, almost like Alice in Wonderland, Santa Claus, and Rudolph the Drunk, the Red-Nosed Reindeer. In just a second, I want to read to you something about the way children are taught about the origins of life, and they're not asked to believe in any alternatives whatsoever. But first, some very interesting quotations from a leading evolutionary scientist, Loren Isley, in a book called The Immense Journey. Biologists have poured, he said, analyzed, minced, and shredded recalcitrant protoplasm into a fruitless attempt to create life from non-living matter. Now, science has not yet created life, and it never will. Not in a test tube, even though by the time science writers and newspapers begin to sensationalize this or that or the other discovery or this or that or the other acid or amino acid, including some which may have come out of lunar rock, and say, well, these are similar to that which is found in living cells. Sure they are, because human beings and all living cells, for that matter, come from the elements and the minerals and the various rocks of the earth. Of course they're similar. That ought to show us that there is a similar master mind, that there was a master designer who had the same plan and purpose, who used the same materials, but we miss that somehow. 100 years ago, Dr. Isley said, men spoke optimistically about solving the secret, that is, how life could have come into existence from not life, non-life, not living, dead, inert matter. Or, at the very least, they thought the next generation would be in a position to do so. Periodically, there were claims that the emergence of life from matter had been observed. Now, years and years ago, you would have been laughed out of the scientific classroom if you denied that mice came from hot bricks or that flies came from a cloth. But when they discovered the cloth had actually been over a jar in which there was decayed meat, they didn't realize until much later that the flies had been laying eggs on the cloth itself and that the maggots had hatched right there. But they discovered some of those things, so they had to discard that. But the point is, science changes its mind too. It changes with the times, it seems, and today, even though they delve far more deeply into what they used to think was a blob of protoplasm, a simple amoeba, and they discovered it wasn't all that simple. And as our observation capacity grew, and as our technology developed, and we became able to take apart the very stuff of matter, we discovered first that molecules were a tiny part of matter, and we thought that was the tiniest part. Eventually they discovered, no, atoms are the smallest part. Then they discovered, lo and behold, atoms have parts, and that each atom is like a little tiny universe all by itself, with a nucleus and protons, neutrons, and electrons going about in rapid fashion in a kind of an interstellar space in a tiny little thing like an atom. Well, it would take you at about 10,000 times per second, several millennia, to count the molecules in a drop of water, which gives you some idea, I think, of how small an atom is. And, well, whether science really understands that, I don't know. I doubt it. Frankly, they're still trying to adjust the speed of light these days, so nothing is really absolute so far as scientific observation is concerned. But Dr. Isley said if science was not to be embarrassed, the emergence of life had to in some way be accounted for. And they certainly weren't about to turn to Genesis 1 and read where it said in the beginning, God created. Nevertheless, as the years passed, the secret remains locked in its living jelly, in spite of larger microscopes and more formidable means of dissection. As a matter of fact, the mystery was heightened, he said, because all this intensified effort revealed that even a supposedly simple amoeba was a complex, self-operating chemical factory. Well, after having chided the theologian, Dr. Isley admits, for his reliance on myth and miracle, science found itself in the unenviable position of having to create a mythology of its own. Namely, the assumption that what, after long effort, could not be proved to take place today had, in truth, taken place in the primeval past. A little later on, he said, it is simple dogmatism asserting that what you want to believe did, in fact, happen. Now, I've proved to you on this series of programs that evolution is a faith, as it's been stated plainly by some of its foremost proponents, and that it is now simple dogmatism. Then why, in our beliefs of separation of church and state, do we not begin to realize that evolution in itself is also a religion? Just because it puts a capital C on the word chance and says, let us bow down in awe that someday, by chance, life came into existence from the not living, does it make it any less of a religion? Maybe some of its sages and prophets of old were men like Lyell and Huxley and Darwin and the like, instead of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, or Christ himself and the Apostle Paul. Maybe its textbooks are the ones on microbiology, comparative anatomy, geology, astronomy, physiology, anthropology, and the like, where the Bible talks of the book of Genesis, Revelation, the book of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Gospels, and others. But if it's not a religion, then what is it? The deeper you go into it, the more you see there are missing links and broad, yawning chasms of agonizing doubt, inconclusive evidence, perhapses, possibles, and maybes, and an absolute conviction in chance. A believer in evolution has to accept far more miracles than a believer in the Bible. He literally does. The idea of the chance of that happening is beyond the realm of the miraculous. It even gets outside of that, you would begin to think. Now, this beautiful example of the childhood textbook from a book educating younger children, the one called The Story of Mankind by Hendrik Van Loon, waxes so eloquent about reluctant bushes and shrubs. Can you imagine a reluctant rhododendron? Well, in just a moment I'll show you that's the way they paint the picture for the kiddies in the classroom, and it's on the same par of Gulliver's Travels, Mother West Wind, Dr. Seuss, and Mother Goose. I'll be right back.
There's a new Europe coming. From the days when Europe was reduced to rubble at the end of World War II, the Plain Truth has been predicting its rebirth as a world power. As this European bloc develops independently of the United States and Russia, the Plain Truth keeps you informed with advance articles. And now, as the European common market emerges economically and politically to shake the world, The Plain Truth brings you the dramatic story behind Europe's return to power. With articles like Cracks in the Atlantic Alliance and Who Speaks for Europe, The Plain Truth helps you keep ahead of events in this fast-moving world at a price we can all afford. It's free. The Plain Truth, after 40 years, still ahead of its time. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
There are seven incontrovertible proofs that God does exist. The first of those was that law can only come into existence as a result of a great lawgiver. You don't have laws without a lawgiver. The laws, the forces, the energies that act upon us are law-abiding. The only thing we see around us that is lawless is man himself. The cleavage properties of minerals. Now, mineralogy, or the study of minerals, it's a fantastic study. I forget which issue it was, but not too long ago, one of the National Geographic issues came out with some of the most marvelous photography that showed an amazing number of minerals that are commonplace all around us, and some of the properties of these minerals. There are identifying ways in which you can discover which mineral is what. The way it is shaped by the way it forms chemically, and the way it cleaves if you break it, as well as the scratch property of minerals having to do with its hardness and so on. And it's just absolutely amazing when you look into this at the law-abiding properties of rock. The quartz crystals with their exact six little facets. I don't care how hard you have to look, that last one is going to be there somewhere. And the fluoride that is around us and the way it forms and develops. Iron pyrite, commonly called fool's gold. Lead, even common halite and salts, as we call it, and the way it forms, it's incredible. Laws somehow make it work that way. Now, some of these minerals have a glassy cleavage, as they say, so it shatters like glass, as does obsidian, when you break it. And others, I don't care how hard you pound it until you get it into the tiniest dust, it's always going to break in certain angles. Like you have plagioclase, which is many-faceted, or orthoclase, which breaks at right angles. Feldspar, one of the most common rocks of the entire surface of our Earth. And orthoclase feldspar is always going to break at basically right angles. And so I don't care how small you break it, or whether it's one giant cube. They suspect somewhere in Siberia there's one giant cube that's about 1 mile, I believe, in diameter. But you can break it up into dust and look at it under a powerful microscope, and it is broken at right angles. And there's no way for a man to destroy that law. There's no way for a man to break that law. That's just built into these properties of minerals. Water. The plants that, from their root systems, gather these minerals. Now, a root is a fantastically intricate and complex appendage on a plant that somehow takes what otherwise would be to us just a mouthful of rocks and dirt, transforms it into a living metabolic organism. We eat the stalk or the root or the grain, and then we assimilate what otherwise would just be dirt or rocks into our bodies in these chemicals, these elements, these nutrients that make up what we are, and we really are the dirt of this earth, and that's what we survive upon. That's how we assimilate food, as we call it, and we still live. We breathe air into our lungs, we drink the water, we're mostly water, and we have to eat the foods that come out of this earth. And we're absolutely chained to it. Even when men go to the moon, they have to take a little bit of this earth's atmosphere with them in a little capsule, and they are still earthbound creatures. They still have to subsist because of what they take along, a little bit of the atmosphere that is right here on our beautiful spaceship Earth. They can't be without it. They can't live without it. So laws sustain life, and laws require a lawgiver. The only lawless thing around is man. The animals aren't lawless other than by themselves. Plants and all the minerals and everything that acts, the weather in itself and by itself without man's interference, is not lawless, but very law-abiding. You know, it was J. Edgar Hoover who once said, a child, any child who is taught to obey the laws of God will have very little difficulty obeying the laws of man. And how true that is. If we would teach children the existence of profound laws instead of giving them a lot of mythology that virtually suspends law and does away with law. Now listen to this example and ask yourself just which is the most palatable. For a child to be told that Santa Claus exists, which a lot of kids will believe if you tell them. And about Dr. Seuss and Mother Goose and all the nursery rhymes and Hansel und Gretel and some of those German things are really wild. You know, these little kids, you talk about a couple of hungry kids. First, they push the witch into an oven and boil or broil her alive, and then they eat the whole house. I mean, that's one of the most ghastly stories that you can tell a child. I was told that when I was a kid. I don't know that it did anything to me. It may have. I may have had nightmares at the time. I don't remember. But these little kids wandering through the woods, you know, and come upon the little house that's made of solid candy. They eat the whole thing, the eaves, the roots, the partitions, and they throw the witch that lives in the candy cottage into the oven and bake the old gal alive, the three little pigs. Quite a story there. You know, little animals that you get kind of attached to, and they get gobbled up, and then finally the wolf is boiled, and all this stuff, it's unbelievable. Well, we think that's harmless. We ought to tell the kids mythology. I'll tell you, it'd be fantastic if we take what really is, what really does exist, the life forms on this earth, and dramatize those and show those. Now, some of these Disney movies that have come out, life is all around us. A desert may look empty. It may look devoid of life. But that one film that the Disney cinematographers did in a certain amount of animation, but most of that, no, I believe it was devoid of animation. I believe that was almost entirely just wonderful photography. And about the little owls that will build nests in giant saguaro cacti and the ants and the snakes and the rodents and all of the little creatures that the desert is actually, though it appears to be empty and devoid of life, it teems with life. But life is everywhere around us. Now, this type of thing would be so interesting. But instead, here's the kind of substitute modern education offers our children. I read only the top of this, the surface of it, last time. In the beginning goes this textbook on the origin of life, the story of mankind. In the beginning, it tells how the planet was all a great big ball of gas. Then it said, finally the hour came when the sun broke through. One day, a great wonder happened. What had been dead gave birth to life. The first living cell floated upon the waters of the sea, it says here in fine print. For millions of years, it drifted aimlessly with the current. Those are words on paper. For millions of years, this little cell drifted around. Unbelievable. That's right, it is. It's unbelievable. But kids aren't bothered with that. I mean, if Hansel and Gretel can eat the whole house, who's gonna be amazed or overwhelmed or perplexed at grade one or two or six if it took millions of years for one little cell to drift around in the current? It sounds fairly plausible to a child. So does the moon being made out of green cheese. A kid will believe exactly what you tell him. He doesn't question dad and mom at certain ages. That comes later. But in the beginning, he doesn't really question dad and mom. That's where racism comes from. That's where fear, and that's where a lot of hang-ups and tied-up kids, that's where they come from. They come from the factory. You know, the factory is known by the manufacturing process and by the product that comes out the other end, the assembly line. And if a certain automobile has a certain designer and there's a certain flair that he likes to put in the cars, you can spot it coming down the road. You know it by the designer, the factory. Now, nobody, I don't care how many teachers try, can whip parents when it comes to indelibly impressing certain deep beliefs and impressions upon their children. If you started by telling a child, and the word go, that the moon was green Swiss cheese, he would believe you. And eventually, though he would learn otherwise, it would still bother him from time to time. It would take him a while to get over it, like a little kid that said, well, I discovered, and he was crying, you know, that Santa Claus does not exist, and now I'm going to look into this Jesus Christ business, too. Now, he was an enterprising young boy. Not all children might act that way, but here's the way the story goes. During all that time that this one cell was drifting aimlessly and developing certain habits, that it might survive more easily upon the inhospitable earth, some of these cells were happiest in the dark depths of the lakes and the pools. Now, I've never seen an unhappy cell, but that's the way you describe it for little kiddies. See, you make it interesting for them. They took root. A cell taking root. A root is a collection of many, many thousands upon thousands of cells arranged in such an intricate manner that they can assimilate the nutrients from soil and make them a part of living protoplasm that can become a part of our very bodies in a metabolic, living, breathing organism. What do you mean a cell took root, but here it is, it's in the book. You know, there was a record on that, wasn't there, one time? It's in the book, Grandma's Lysope, something like that. Well, you begin to think this ought to be to the accompaniment of music because it just is such a beautiful tale. But the point is, the point I'm trying to make here is, it belongs in a nursery rhyme. If somebody's going to say, look, it's okay to teach kids mythology, let's label it what it is. This is just as much mythology as Dr. Seuss and Mother Goose, the idea that a cell took root. It doesn't happen, it can't happen, it never did happen, it's total fiction. But it performs quite a job. It puts indelibly in the minds of impressionable young children the idea that there is no God and that they are the result of seaweeds or of green slime, and that therefore if there's no God, then why have any conscience toward that God? And why worry about obeying any of His laws or principles? And why bother believing in the religion of our fathers? Why bother believing in the beliefs and the religions of men like a George Washington, or maybe an Alexander Hamilton, or a Benjamin Franklin, or maybe an Abraham Lincoln? Why not take all of the time-honored institutions of a country that were founded upon the belief in God and destroy them all? You know, it was Lenin who once said, give me the hearts of the children and I will rule the world. Evolution is atheism. Communism believes in atheism, and that religion is the opiate of the public. I hurl that back at them to say that evolution is quite an opiate, except I think it's more dangerous, maybe on the level of LSD, because it takes you on quite a trip, clear into the outer reaches of space, and tries to tell you that the fathomless, limitless universe all just happened by chance, with a capital C, before which you are to bow and give subservience, because it's the only God an evolutionist is ever going to worship. Well, what do you think about that? I'll come back in just a moment and show you the rest of this fantastic quotation, and then we'll get down to the business of establishing, incontrovertibly, the second major proof that God does exist.
One question that has bothered man for centuries probably has bothered you too. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem, and it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? Whether you feel that organized religion is ritual or reality, the question still remains. The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a creator God. There is no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. Request your free copy of Does God Exist? Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
You know, we could either tell our kids the truth or we could lie to them. It just depends on what we want them to believe. If we want them to believe in lies, since society is largely founded upon lies, then let's get busy and tell them that's precisely what we want them to do. But this is a day of rational alternatives. We like to allow kids the alternative. And so the Supreme Court ruled that no more prayers. You can't pray to God. Well, I suppose the people of the Muslim faith, the Muslim religion, we're pleased to hear this. So some people didn't get all that upset when prayers were taken out of the schools. I didn't either, for one, though I think that there ought to be some more of a rational explanation as to why. It's just that I couldn't see that prayers in the schools were doing all that much good, because the kinds of prayers that were being offered, I don't think were really being answered all that much. But if it's mythology, why don't we say it's mythology and not pretend that it's something else? The point is, this masquerades as science. And science itself admits this cannot happen. Eminent scientists have been very candid and very open to admit there are no proofs for these things occurring, that it's all supposition. But by the time you dress it up for the child's mind, it becomes very, very palatable and on the par with some of the most rosy stories that children believe. It said one day the great wonder happened. What had been dead gave birth to life. Utterly impossible, but a kid will believe it. For millions of years, it drifted aimlessly with the currents, and then one day, it took root in the slimy sediments which had been carried down from the top of the hills, and they, these little cells taking root, became plants. That's what it says here. Others preferred to move about, and they grew strange jointed legs. How about that? A plant preferred, it had a preference, to move about, and it grew strange jointed legs, not funny, pudgy ones, not commonplace, everyday, hairy ones, but strange, jointed ones, like scorpions, and began to crawl along the bottom of the sea, amidst the plants and the pale green things that looked like jellyfishes. Still others, covered with scales, depended upon a swimming motion to go from place to place. A little later on, I'm going to take you through the chances and the possibilities and the maybes of how all this might have happened. What is a scale? Did feathers evolve from a loose, hanging scale? You know, that's what they claim. They claim one day a sea creature slithered ashore. And it's like, you know, on the BC strip one time, the snake was crawling along the pile of leaves there, and you heard slither, slither, slither. And this woman, Neanderthal type, came out with this giant club. Wham, 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 wham. And so you see this snake, and he's lying there like a burnt match, and he says, I got to quiet down my slither. Well, they tell it in evolution that one day some sea creature slithered out upon the land, and he was knocking around among the rocks, and he had a couple of scales that were hanging loose, and those became feathers, and eventually this creature began to fly. Well, we'll find out eventually in this series just what are the real chances, what is the likelihood of something like that really happening, and whether it makes sense or is it one of the wildest stories of abstract mythology to ever come along dressed up in the tuxedo of science. It's time somebody took issue with it, because it's undermining the very founding faith of the American people. It's right at the very basic building block of what we are, what we're doing on the earth, what our purpose individually and collectively should be. Our place among nations and the community of nations on this earth is in dangerous jeopardy because we are casting aside most of the really important social institutions that should be preserved, and more importantly, our homes are in trouble, deep trouble. And if our homes and families are in trouble, the nation itself is in double jeopardy. Because we, as a nation, are only going to be as strong as are our individual homes. Once you throw aside the knowledge of God, you decide evolution is true, you decide there is no need to believe in a creator, all-wise, divine being who sees all things, who gave us the handbook about humankind. Once you jump the tracks of true science and get into wild, speculative, mindless, kind of a dogmatic theology that masquerades for science, then somebody ought to call a spade and say, look, if prayers aren't allowed in a classroom, then why is all this superstition labeled evolution? Well, I'm going to show you that it is a superstition. I'm not kidding about that. Because words like this, for example, quote, reluctantly these plants left the water and made a new home in the marshes. Twice a day the tides of the ocean covered them with brine. The rest of the time the plants made the best of their uncomfortable situation. After centuries of training, they learned how to live as comfortably in the air as they did in the sea. They increased in size and became shrubs and trees, and at last learned how to grow lovely flowers which attracted the attention of the busy bees, end of quote. Isn't that a beautiful flowery tale? That's exactly what it is, a flowery tale. It's total fiction. It belongs with Dr. Seuss and Mother Goose and nursery rhymes. It doesn't make a bit of sense. I don't care how much practice plants have. I've never seen plants practice doing anything except just lying there. And somebody's going to say, yes, but you can't see evolution. And I'll say, that's for sure. You sure can't. Not even in the rocks, not in the evidence of the tools of science, not by measurement, observation, and weight, not by experimentation, not by logicality or rationality, and not by any other method of reasoning left to human beings except an unbelievable abyssal nightmare, wild daydreams, or a psychedelic trip. You simply cannot reconcile the idea of a reluctant plant gradually being forced to leave a marsh. I mean, I've never even seen a reluctant plant. It just doesn't make a bit of sense. A great incontrovertible proof of God is that life comes only from pre-existing life. You need to write to the booklet, Does God Exist? All you need to do to receive this booklet is to give us the call letters of your station. We'd like that. You would, please. The call letters of your radio station. While you're at it, why don't you request the current number of the Plain Truth and find that there is a solution beyond human understanding. And we talk in the Plain Truth plainly even about Bible prophecy and about an ultimate solution beyond the acknowledgement of today's news media because they simply do not acknowledge God or Bible prophecy. And that's what you will read in the Plain Truth. It is Plain Truth, straight from the shoulder, plain talk. I hope you'll write for it, and then you can send your letter to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Remember, there is absolutely no advertising in any of the literature I've announced. There's no request for money. It's free of charge, no price whatsoever. The address, again, is Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, brought to you by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your request along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales.